This is the New Criterion. I'm James Panero, executive editor, with a special edition of the podcast. From the New Criterion's Edmund Burke Award for Service to Culture and Society, we welcome and congratulate our 2019 recipient, Andrew Roberts.
Thank you very much indeed, James.
The Edmund Burke Award honors individuals who have made conspicuous contributions to the defense of civilization. Andrew, you have contributed to this defense not just conspicuously, but joyfully.
That's very kind of you. I greatly appreciate that.
From your best-selling histories of the Second World War through your history of the English-speaking people since 1900 and your life in Napoleon, on to your latest bestseller, Churchill Walking with Destiny, your astonishing books are a delight to read because you make communion with the great figures of our history. Just as Churchill walked with destiny, you write with destiny, including for the pages of the New Criterion. And it is an honor for all of us to join you here tonight.
Well, I love the New Criterion. I think it's a monthly infusion of intelligence and common sense and wit, and I love writing for it as well.
Oh, well, we love having you. And I should let our listeners and viewers know that when we last saw you some 2 months ago, you were just embarking on your American book tour for Churchill. Now here you are in the middle of it. What have you discovered along the way about America's affinity for Winston Churchill?
Well, Americans love Churchill. I think that they actually love Churchill more than the Britons do. Britons, my countrymen, tend to get hung up on some completely trivial details of Churchill's career, especially things to do with industrial relations and other, frankly, completely unimportant aspects of him, which you're not. You actually have a perspective that is far more important. You look at the really big issues, the way in which he, on three occasions, he got the most important things right during the 20th century with regard to Prussian militarism and the Nazis and the communists. And so actually, if anything, I think this side of the Atlantic has a much more healthy view of Churchill, even than on mine.
From Napoleon through Churchill, you write what some may deride as great man stories of history. Well, whatever happened to the histories of great men? Why are such histories challenged today?
Because of Marxism and the Whig view of history and the determinists. The idea that great individuals, not just men, of course, women as well, made a real contribution, a changing contribution to history, has been derided by people who just want to see vast impersonal forces as the driving forces of history. As soon as you actually look, though, at that closely, you realize, and especially, of course, in the case of Napoleon and indeed of Churchill, that it's complete tripe. Actually, individuals are vital to history. In fact, history is only the collected experience of millions of individuals.
Well, I want to ask about the particular challenge of writing a new history of Churchill. There are already some 1,000 books on the subject. Sir Martin Gilbert wrote Churchill's official 8-volume biography. And Churchill himself wrote some 37 books, 5,000 speeches, and a 6-volume account of the Second World War, totaling nearly 2 million words, a story you tell in your introduction. He even won the Nobel Prize in Literature, and his parliamentary career spans some 63 years. How do you contend with such a record, and how do you look to add to this history?
Well, it is a huge record, of course. Partly because you can't take every word that Churchill says about himself as true. He tried to make himself to be thicker than he was, in fact, in his autobiography, My Early Life. Very rare for politicians to underplay their own intelligence, but Churchill did. The second thing, of course, is that there have been a huge amount of new sources, new areas of information that have become available. And so I've managed to mine all of those and make my book different from the 1,009, in fact, that have come before. So I think there's still some space for saying something about Churchill that hasn't been said over and over again.
Well, I gather from your acknowledgements that you had some special access that other historians have not had. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I was very fortunate to be allowed to be the first Churchill biographer to actually have access to Her Majesty the Queen's father's diaries. King George VI met Winston Churchill every Tuesday of the Second World War. They had lunch together at Buckingham Palace, and the King was trusted by Churchill with all of the great secrets of the Second World War, and luckily he wrote everything down. And so that's proved to be a great new source. But on top of that, there have been 41 sets of papers that have been deposited at Churchill College archives since the last biography of Churchill. The Soviet ambassador's diaries are now available. I myself, a few years ago, found the verbatim accounts of the War Cabinet, and those have been tremendously helpful, as well as the Churchill family allowing me to see some documents and papers that haven't been seen by anyone else at all, including Churchill's daughter's 1940 diary. So there's something on pretty much every page of this book that's never appeared in a biography of Churchill ever before, and that also, I think, makes this book worthwhile.
Well, you put us writers to shame, because I understand you wrote your 1,000-page biography, and how long did it take you?
It took me 100 days. I can write, yes, but it's an absurd thing, and it's not very good for my health, I don't think. I start at 4 or 4.30 in the morning, go through until lunchtime, and then I drink a can of Red Bull, which keeps me wired like this for another few hours. And so I managed to write 5,000 words a day. And therefore, this whole book was written in 100 days.
Well, your book has been praised as exquisitely written by Comrade Black in Our Pages, and other outlets have called it surely the best single-volume biography of Churchill yet written. What did you learn about Churchill's sense of destiny in writing this book?
Well, I very much chose the subtitle Walking with Destiny, not just because it sounds good. I've been told by an English friend that all Americans are interested in destiny and all British people are interested in walking. but I actually chose it, of course, because it mentions his great reference to the day that he became Prime Minister on the 10th of May 1940, in which he said, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." And that's a important aspect of Churchill, this sense, this driving sense of personal destiny that he had all his life, that he was going to save England and save London.
I noticed that a writer for The Guardian used your book to attack Churchill's, quote, racism and paternalism and, quote, vindictiveness influenced by his racist views. Last year, a retired American astronaut tweeted out a quote by Churchill and then felt the need to retract it after facing down an online firestorm. Quote, "Did not mean to offend by quoting Churchill," he wrote. "My apologies. I will go and educate myself further on his atrocities, racist views, which I do not support." Well, Churchill lived much of his life under real attack, facing down both the Bolshies and the Huns, as he called them. Why is he virtually besieged today?
Well, of course, I'm always delighted to be attacked by The Guardian. It's absolutely essential. If you're not attacked by The Guardian, you don't know that you're on the right track. But with regard to the accusations of racism, I think it really is very important to remember that he was born in the same time that Charles Darwin was still alive. And people believed in a hierarchy of races in those days. And however much we know that to be ludicrous and obscene, they thought at the time that it was scientific fact. So he's been attacked for that. I don't think that's fair to attack somebody for something in that ahistorical way. But he's also been attacked for all sorts of other things, and many things of which he was guilty. This is not a hagiography. I do attack Churchill on myself on several of the mistakes, the blunders that he'd made in his life. But as he told his own wife, Clementine, from the trenches in 1916, "I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes."
Yes. Mm. Tonight you're delivering remarks on Churchill's debt to Burke. How much was Edmund Burke in the mind of Winston Churchill?
A lot. Churchill admired Burke hugely. He read him widely. He quoted him. And I think that Burke's thought affected Churchill's beliefs as well in a profound way. It is not just luck that that Churchill again and again quotes from Edmund Burke.
You are a writer, a reader, and a friend of the New Criterion. What in particular brings you to our pages?
I think it's actually the fact that you are setting yourself athwart history in William F. Buckley's famous phrase. And that's a brave place to be. It really is. And again and again, not just the quality of the writing, although, of course, that is always attractive, indeed a prerequisite for a successful magazine like yours, but also the sheer moral courage that you show again and again in setting yourself apart. And that's something, that's a very Churchillian quality, moral courage. It's not quite the same thing as physical courage. It's something that is vital if you are to keep civilization on track. People have to absolutely be allowed to speak what they see as the truth. And the New Criterion never backs down from that.
You have been listening to The New Criterion. From The New Criterion's Edmund Burke Award for Service to Culture and Society, we are joined by our 2019 recipient, Andrew Roberts. Andrew, thank you and congratulations.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a great honor.